Welcome to Only in America. I'm Ali Nirani.
Only in America.
Only in America.
Only in America.
Only in America.
This week, the difficult decisions that lead migrants to seek safety in the United States.
I talked to one dad, and he was from Honduras, and it was obvious the love he had for his country and how much he would rather be there. And through a series of events, you know, that was no longer possible. His house had been completely shot up. His car had either been firebombed or something like that exploded. But he had a good job and benefits. His wife had a good job, and they wanted to raise their family in peace in their home country, and that's just no longer possible. I don't think this guy thinks that the United States is necessarily better. Better would be for him to be in his home country.
And how an Army veteran found her way to Moline, Illinois, to pastor a church and serve the immigrant community.
I'm grateful for my military experience. I felt like it taught me how to mobilize and lead people in a way that is accessible for them. I feel like the military, living overseas, have both been things that God's been able to use in surprising ways in ministry, for sure.
From the National Immigration Forum, I'm Ali Nirani. These days, division and polarization dominate our news cycle. You can't open a newspaper, you can't open a website, you can't do anything without feeling it. But there are shimmers of bright light that dot the landscape, particularly, of all places, along the U.S.-Mexico border. In churches and community organizations from San Diego to Brownsville are pockets of hope, empathy, and kindness. Within the walls of these community institutions are volunteers offering food, shelter, medicine, showers, just a kind ear to listen to migrants who have been released by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. In fact, you don't have to look any further than Pastor Carlos Navarro with the Baptist Church of West Brownsville in Texas. Last week, the Guatemalan-born pastor, now a U.S. citizen, converted half of his church into a welcoming center for newly released migrants. KENS 5 television told Pastor Navarro's story.
It's the nuances of the Central American cultures that he grew up with that allows him to be relatable.
Ya están en los Estados Unidos. Ya esta pesadilla se terminó. The horror movie, it's over. This is the last chapter. You're not going to see it anymore.
Every day for the past week, Pastor Navarro and his army of volunteers have taken in up to 50 families dropped off by local authorities after being released by Border Patrol. The continued surge of undocumented asylum seekers have overwhelmed both the federal government and local charities, prompting Navarro to answer the call.
I do it because my heart tells me to do it.
And the call is not just heard along the border. It's being picked up by good people across the country, including my guest today, Beth Cosson from Moline, Illinois. Last week, Beth was part of an 8-person delegation organized by my friend, Dr. Joanne Lyon, who is General Superintendent Emerita and Ambassador of the Wesleyan Church. Dr. Lyon organized a delegation of 8 clergywomen last week to spend a few days visiting El Paso, Texas, and crossing the border to visit Ciudad Juarez. Beth, like I said, was a part of this 8-person delegation. My conversation with Beth covered everything from her military experience, her path to the Quad Cities region with her husband, and the stories that she saw and heard from the U.S.-Mexico border last week that she feels she has the responsibility to share with her church and her community. Beth, thank you very much for joining me today. I am so looking forward to this conversation.
Thank you. I am as well.
Before we kind of get into the trip that you took last week, tell me about Moline, Illinois.
Well, Moline is part of the Quad Cities, which are 4 cities, Rock Island and Moline, Illinois, and Bettendorf and Davenport, Iowa. It has about 500,000 people in the greater Quad City area. The Mississippi River divides us, and it's fairly diverse. It's a refugee resettlement area, so we've got quite an influx of people coming from all over the world. There's a Midwest sensibility to it, but also I would say we've got some big city problems with small town infrastructure to tackle those issues.
What's your journey to Moline?
Well, it's been circuitous, I'll say that for it. My dad was in the Air Force, and so we lived all over the United States. And my high school years I spent in Panama during the 80s, so it was during the turbulence of the Noriega years, as well as the activity with the cartel in Colombia. And so that created a crisis for people there. And so they would often move north up into Panama. And then from there, I went to Wheaton College, where I met my husband. And then I served in the United States Army as a captain in the Military Intelligence Corps. And the basic course for military intelligence is down at Fort Huachuca in Arizona, way down by the border with Mexico. And I served in the military for almost 5 years and then got out and then ended up becoming a pastor, which is a very interesting and surprising development even for me. And so started in the Methodist Church and then ended up in the Wesleyan Church, which is where I've been for almost the last 20 years.
Have you been in Moline for those 20 years?
We've been in Moline for about 5.5 years. Before that, my husband and I were in Pennsylvania. He was a state trooper, and then he also retired from law enforcement, and he's a pastor as well. And so we both pastor and ended up coming out to a church in the Quad Cities here.
It's an interesting and incredible journey.
Yeah, it is. It's been full of twists and turns, but God's been good and faithful through all of it. And I feel like I'm grateful for all the experiences, the growing up in a military home, having the opportunity to live overseas, serving in the military myself, I think has all served to give me maybe a more holistic perspective. So I'm grateful for it.
How do you think that sheer range of experiences informs your take and relationship to the issue of immigration and refugee resettlement?
I think if you've ever lived outside the United States, it affords you the opportunity to have a different perspective on the opportunities that we have here, the privilege that we enjoy as United States citizens. And then also to be exposed to how other people view the United States. And so I feel like my time in Panama helped me to be committed to understanding the global perspective on the United States. I mean, I think it's our challenge in the United States is often to be ethnocentric about what we're seeing or reading or how we're interpreting things. So I've really tried, sometimes with better effect than others, to get outside of that and to really hear the perspective that the world has on who we are and what we're doing and pay attention to that. I think also just empathy is something that I feel is lacking maybe in our current climate. Maybe it has been for a long time, just the ability to move beyond compassion, but actually into action. I'm grateful for my military experience. I felt like it taught me how to mobilize and lead people in a way that is accessible for them. And also to be sure of myself in that space. And so I feel like the military living overseas have both been things that God's been able to use in surprising ways in ministry, for sure.
As you may have noticed, immigration has been in the news for the last couple of years. So how has that played out in Moline, in your church, with your family?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that our community is any different than other communities where the issues become so polarizing and politicized that it's difficult to have discourse that's productive, which is frustrating, I think, for those of us who are dealing with the consequences of not having immigration reform and the system being so broken. Because I feel like at the end of the day, if we can't talk well about this, we're really hosed. I mean, we're just not going to move the needle at all. And that's really what's desperately needed. I feel like our church has had an interesting opportunity. We had a bilingual campus when my husband and I arrived here in the Quad Cities. One of our campuses is a bilingual campus targeted in connecting with the Hispanic community. But it was located outside of the Hispanic corridor, which runs kind of along the Mississippi River. And so we committed pretty early on to relocating that community into the Hispanic community, that campus. And so we purchased a school that had been decided by the district that it would close and retrofitted it and turned it into the Esperanza Center. And our vision for that center has been to be a center for community collaboration and to be a space where people could come together and work on substantive issues like immigration. And we've really seen that come to fruition, which has been just a huge blessing to us and so exciting to get to be a part of it. And in the course of that, one of the things that we did was we spent a lot of time listening to not only what are the needs, but what are the assets? What are the great things that are happening in the community? And how can we just throw some gasoline on that? And immigration was identified as one of the huge huge needs that the community wanted to deal with. The Hispanic community was underserved. I think we had some pretty good resources for refugees that were coming in, especially during their initial resettlement. But the Hispanic community really didn't have access to service. And many people were going all the way to Chicago, which was, you know, the waiting lists were incredible. And so we started on the journey to open a legal assistance center, which we did in January of 2017. And that has really put us on the front lines of the conversation here in the Quad Cities and even a little bit further. Just as we, you don't know who's going to walk in through your doors, what their case will present. And I feel like one of the most important things that we've done is been regarded to be an honest broker, if you will, of someone's options in the system, which, you know, all too often they've been told they have options, they spend a lot of money, and it's a road leading nowhere. And so we are committed to providing consultations where we let people know if there really isn't a path forward for them. And I think the frustration around increasingly having to do that has been something that's building for us, I know, and other people who are engaged in the work that, in good conscience, I don't believe that we can have people in a system that ultimately doesn't lead them towards what we are promising that it will, which is, you know, citizenship.
Mm-hmm. I have so much admiration for the work that's happening on the front lines. And, you know, you have to tell people no over and over and over again. And it must be so awful. So speaking of listening, last week, you were part of a group that visited El Paso and Ciudad Juarez, right?
Yes.
What led you to make the decision to go to the border and see and hear what was happening?
Well, I've been committed for a long time to, when invited into a hard space, to say yes, if at all possible, to bear witness to what is happening. I think, especially in America, we do a great job of insulating ourselves from the uncomfortable things that we just don't want to deal with. And so I know that it's important for some of us to venture out and to actually bear witness to the reality of suffering, to the reality of crisis, to the reality of tragedy, and then to not just bear witness to it there, but to bring that back into the spaces that we occupy and disturb the norm and to call people into a new awakening, a new level of responsibility for what's happening just a few hundred miles or a few thousand miles. Or, I mean, sometimes the distances are so small and yet we're so insulated. It's amazing. So I was invited by Dr. Joanne Lyon.
One of the best people in the world.
Oh, I totally agree. And pretty much if she invites me anywhere, I say yes and then figure out all the details later. And so she invited a small group of clergy women and two academics from universities into the space to bear witness, to learn, to listen, to see people, to look them in the eye and tell them that they are valued and they have dignity and worth. And yeah, it felt like a really small contribution, but I'm grateful for the opportunity.
So what was the difference between what you saw in El Paso and what you saw in Juarez? Or was there a difference?
So Remain in Mexico was really just starting to go into effect when we were there. And so I think what was maybe different and surprising a little bit was the amount of people who had actually presented at the border and then were waiting in Mexico until their court date, when they will then travel into El Paso would be the court assignment for them. So that was new because it was people who had already, they felt like they should have been at a certain point in their journey, and then they were sent back to wait in Mexico instead of going on to where their family is or the location that they're trying to get to. So that created, I think, some tension and frustration for the people who were trying to understand that, because it was a new policy that we just, I mean, it literally was kind of happening as we were there.
And, you know, we've just seen over the last week those numbers as reported that the administration is, like you said, people are presenting to ask for asylum and being sent back to Mexico to wait. Mm-hmm. What were they saying? And what did that frustration sound like?
I think it sounded like pain and confusion. I feel like, for sure, the message that people are receiving in Honduras and El Salvador, which was primarily those were the two countries that the people that we were interacting with were from, I feel like they're not really told the whole story. And so, you know, and I don't know who's shaping the narrative there. And I think there's certainly some more work to do on that, either a counter narrative or a more truthful narrative about what the journey entails, what the risks are. And even once they get to the border, that that's not the end of the journey. It felt like a lot of them felt like when they presented at the border, there would be just received with wide open arms on the other side. There would be, you know, a fast track to their destination, which most of them had family that they were trying to get to in a specific spot in the United States. And so I think to have traveled all that way, many of them, you know, weeks and weeks in the journey, a lot of hardship, and to get to the border and then to not even be admitted entry at that point, but sent back to Mexico. That's just not part of what they've been told. They really had no grid for understanding what was even happening at that point. And then I think, of course, there's fear that we've invested all of this in this journey. And, you know, if you have an end in sight, you kind of have energy to get to the end in sight. And they were deflated, I think, the people that we talked to and saw, because they don't have energy for another leg of waiting and uncertainty.
Mm-hmm. Did you get into a sense of why people were making the journey to begin with?
Well, certainly. I mean, most of the stories, the large majority of the stories that we heard were people who were fleeing violence, usually from gangs. A lot of them had had a sibling, a spouse, even a child killed because of gang violence. And usually it was that sense of desperation that they would with certainty be killed if they stayed. And a better alternative is to give their family a chance at a life. Even though they knew that there was some risk involved in that, it felt like it was certain death if they stayed. And so there really was a sense of almost not having a choice, that this was the only chance at life.
And then the response of churches on the border, you know, I've read and I've talked to some of the folks down there, and it's just incredible the leadership that people are showing. But it's been going on a long time. And are folks on the U.S. side of the border, how are they experiencing this? Because they're kind of on the front line now of a response.
Right. So the churches that we interacted with on the U.S. side, I think it was incredible how many of them have stepped up into this space where, you know, after ICE has processed someone goes through Border Patrol, it's a very quick processing. And then ICE is releasing people to churches. Annunciation House in El Paso is doing great work, as well as Ciudad Juarez, in trying to coordinate some of where ICE is taking people. But we were at a very tiny church that is, for the last 5 weeks, been receiving daily between 60 and 70 migrants who are just dropped off by a bus with nothing. They need showers. They still have the dust of their week-long journey on them. Many of the children were sick. And just with volunteers and with donated resources, that church is just going to work every day to help really make travel arrangements for these individuals to wherever their court date is set, which is usually where their family is located. They give them some basic hygiene supplies, help them get cleaned up. They get them new clothes. They give them army cots set up in their little tiny sanctuary, and they can rest with their children. And one thing that was remarkable to me, we interacted at that place two times with two totally different groups of migrants, and they were all in family units of some sort. So whether it was a dad with two children or a mom with a child, they were all traveling with children.
And how did that change things?
Well, I think it's a startling dynamic to walk into and to see not just adults, but to see children who are suffering. I mean, the children were sick. The children had obviously been traumatized, many of them. They were just, I would say, shell-shocked. We interacted with one group who had just been dropped off by ICE, so they hadn't had any time to get cleaned up. And we walked in the space, and it was quiet, except for a few cries of some children. And that was, you know, 70, 75 people in a very tiny space. And there was just this heavy feeling in the air. And so we walked in and started to assess. And of course, the volunteers are just exhausted because they didn't sign up for this. They didn't know that this would be going on 5 weeks later and that it would be an everyday thing. And so we tried to spell them as we could and take around some basic medicine and some items to clean up a little bit, just to talk with them. I spent time with the dads and their children. And many of them are overwhelmed. Some of them were traveling with their children because their wife stayed back with another one of their children. Or I talked to a dad whose wife had actually been killed and his son, and he was traveling with his daughter. And so they're processing not just the last 24 hours or 48 hours, but I think a lot of them, the width and breadth of what they've been through is really starting to catch up with them. And so these are people who've experienced a lot of trauma, experienced a lot of hardship, and sacrificed so much to get here. It's just, I talked to one dad. He was telling us a story, and he was from Honduras, and it was obvious the love he had for his country and how much he would rather be there. And through a series of events, you know, that was no longer possible. His house had been completely shot up. His car had had a either been firebombed or something like that exploded. But he had a good job and benefits. His wife had a good job, and they wanted to raise their family in peace in their home country. And that's just no longer possible. And so just as he talked about the grief of that, the loss of country really overwhelmed him and was painful to bear witness to, because here I sit in my privilege in a country where I don't even have to think about that. It's really striking, that difference. And I think we can idolize what we have here and sort of think that everybody's leaving their country for something better. And I don't think this guy thinks that the United States is necessarily better. Better would be for him to be in his home country. That's just no longer possible for him. And so it's not he's abandoning his country, he doesn't love his country. He needs respite, really, and a place to heal until, you know, I would say that in talking with him, he'd be one of the first ones to go back if his country could become more stable and violence wasn't the rule of the day.
I feel like that's it's a perspective on the journey of migrants that we don't hear. Mm-hmm. That decision of why somebody had to leave. And that's not an easy decision. Mm-hmm. And we don't tell that story. We don't hear that story.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he had tried for 9 months to find any other way. He tried everything to stay. And I think we have to honor that tenacity and that perseverance to stay for 9 months in a situation that we'll never have to deal with.
So as a pastor, as somebody who has traveled and lived around the world, as someone who has served in the military, how did you feel hearing these stories?
It's always humbling to hear the stories of people who've endured so much. And I hold that as a sacred trust. I always want to protect them and honor them in their story. But I also feel a huge responsibility when someone shared a story like that with me. And I'm always clear in the interaction with people that, you know, getting permission to be able to represent their story respectfully to other people. And so I definitely feel the weight of it, but I also feel like it's a sacred trust that I've got to hold up my end of that, which is to represent these stories now to really anyone who will listen. And so when I preach this weekend, I share the story of this man from Honduras, because it's important to have our narrative about what's happening be truthful. And I think that that has been difficult to find in America right now. Just a truthful narrative, an unbiased narrative, a narrative that just is, everybody has their slant on it. And I think stories of people, they just are. They don't necessarily have agenda. They're raw. And so the ability to put that out there and then to say to people, whether it's church or the Lions Club or a Chamber of Commerce, to say, what then is our responsibility as humans to another human who's having this experience, who's living this story? And I think that we all have a responsibility to each other because we belong to each other. And that's really my heart in this, is to invite people into that space of what does belonging to each other really look like and mean in the day and age that we live in.
You had said at the beginning of the conversation that you wanted to hear what was happening there, and I think you said disrupt the norms of your community. Mm-hmm. Is your sermon over the weekend kind of the first step in that process?
Well, I think I'm probably always wired towards doing that. So I think, you know, as for sure, since we've been doing the Legal Assistance Center, you know, I'm on the radar as far as disrupting the norms. I think what was particularly hard about this trip is, and it is for me whenever I travel somewhere and bear witness to something, that you come back to your regularly scheduled life and people have no idea, you know, and so they are going on with their life and inside you're screaming, but don't you understand what's happening? You know, and it's wherever you've been. And so I have to manage that tension a lot, but I feel a renewed sense of urgency. It didn't matter whether we were talking with Border Patrol or a pastor or an Uber driver. It didn't matter who we were talking to in the El Paso Juarez border area. They were articulating a desperate need for immigration reform. And I feel like we've got to get to a point where even people who aren't affected by that need in their everyday 24/7, 365 life, where they feel that pinch also. And they just say enough is enough. We need reform. We can't have a system that's outdated and not pliable and not responsive to the needs that we as a country have and that the world has. And we're just not there, because as much as I've engaged with it, I come back here and I'm looking around and nobody's talking about it here. We're in El Paso. The headlines of their local paper every day, their whole front page is all about different things that are happening, whether it's immigration reform or homeland security or ICE or a border conversation. It's all about that. And really, we probably need to feel that tension a little bit more in our country for something to actually happen. And so I guess I'm happy to increase that tension where I live.
Oh my. I feel like we could talk for at least 4 more hours, but at some point one of us has yeah. a real job. So my last question for you is a question I ask everybody, and that's to complete the sentence. Only in America, ...
Wow, there's so many things that come to mind. I think I would say only in America do we have the opportunity to actually be the beautiful nation that migrants and refugees sacrifice everything to get to. We can do better than we're doing right now.
Thank you, Beth.
Thank you.
Beth Cawson is the site director for the Esperanza Legal Assistance Center and serves as a network pastor for Heritage Church in the Quad Cities region that straddles Illinois and Iowa. And for more about Beth, please visit our website, immigrationforum.org. And while you're there, take a minute, subscribe to Only in America, and take another minute, and share this week's episode with your friends and your family. Thank you.
Support for the National Immigration Forum comes from the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California, and from the Carnegie Corporation of New York, established in 1911 by Andrew Carnegie to promote the advancement and diffusion of knowledge and understanding.
Only in America is produced by Regina Medina and Emily Chow. Our sound editor this week is Joanna Taylor. Kathleen Farrell is the executive producer, and me, I'm Ali Nirani. Thank you so much for listening, and I will talk to you next week.